Welcome back to Stacktrace, your weekly mix between tech news and technical insights, deep dives, and much more. With me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. I'm doing great here. What have you been doing?
I've been continuing my game development journey. I think this might turn into the next, like, John's static site generator corner Stacktrace, where, you know, everybody loves when I always talk about the same topic over and over again, right? But that's just how I work. Like, when I get excited about something, I like to, like, focus in on it and learn a lot about it and do a lot of experimentation and prototyping and sharing things. And yeah, I just really enjoy doing that. So I will probably do it here now for the next couple of weeks, as I have been really doing a lot of game development lately, which has been a lot of fun. Of course, I've been doing a lot of other work as well, but this has been my main kind of hobby project right now, building this new game that I've been sharing some screenshots on Twitter. And I also think that it's fun to talk about it because I am using Swift UI for the UI part of the game, which has proven really interesting and challenging in some ways, and also really cool. So I think that there's a lot to kind of unpack there.
Yeah, but John, we all know that no one would actually build a game using Swift UI. So why are you doing it?
Yeah, why don't I just use Unity like a normal person, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, this comes up time and time again whenever you're using some technology in a kind of unconventional way, which, if you look at what I've been doing during the last few years, it's kind of been a red thread for me, is that I love to take especially like Swift related things and use them in new contexts. And it's not because I think that Swift is the only language on the planet and everything should be written 100% in Swift or something like that. I enjoy a lot of different programming languages and environments and things like that, but I just love to try to experiment with different technologies in different contexts. And now Swift UI is a big focus for the iOS development community in general. Like, you know, Apple is pushing it very hard. Apple is using themselves a lot. They are focusing a lot on it in sessions and things like that. It's clearly like an important technology for Apple and for the community. So experimenting with it in different contexts is something that really appeals to me. And since I do really enjoy game development, and the fact that I've always struggled when I've been doing game development with the UI part, like a lot of game engines, commercial ones and ones I've built myself and ones that are open source, they're focusing on game rendering and they're not always the best when it comes to user interfaces. And Swift UI, for, you know, all its flaws, or, you know, that in fact that it's a very young framework, it is a great tool for UI development. It's right there in the name, Swift UI. So I thought it would be really interesting to combine a game engine, which I'm using Imagine Engine, my own game engine based on Core Animation, which is open source, with Swift UI. And it's been really fun to combine those two worlds and to really use the game engine for the game part and Swift UI for the UI part.
Yeah, I think we both like to abuse technology to some extent. That's where you find a lot of fun. And it's also hashtag great content, right? I think people really love to see technology being pushed to its limits, such as when I made the Taptic Engine play music on my iPhone. I think
right.
That's the sort of stuff that, first of all, is a lot of fun. And also, you learn a lot by doing it. Not only do you learn new things and techniques, but you also learn the limitations of what you're working with. So if you now need to build an app in Swift UI, you're going to know a lot more about the limitations of Swift UI and where the rough edges are. I think that's a lot of value both for you and for the people who read your content, that they'll learn through you about these rough edges and where the limitations come in. So I think it's a win-win-win situation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think whenever you do push a technology further than its kind of core use case, you do discover a lot of the rough edges or missing pieces or just the limitations. And some of those limitations are, you know, fine that those are in place. I mean, not all technologies can do everything. There's no such thing as a silver bullet. We like to say that, right? Yeah. And I think SwiftUI is no different in that regard. It has some areas of focus and it's expanding, you know, continuously as Apple is improving it. But it's a young piece of technology. It's not 100% capable yet, especially if you compare it to older technologies. And it's probably going to take a while until it is that. But yeah, that's why I love doing this as well, is really to like see where the limits are and how some of those limits could be overcome in more or less hacky ways, and then to like share that, but to always try to be clear around, you know, what is a hack, what is something that I recommend people doing, what is a technology that I would personally put in production versus what is just an experiment, right? Because I do, like we've talked about on previous episodes, I do think that different projects can have different purposes. Sometimes you can just do a project for fun, sometimes you can do it to learn something, or sometimes you're doing it to put it in production. And I work on all of those kinds of projects, and different projects have different purposes.
Absolutely. So I'm looking here at a screenshot you've shared about this game, and I'm really curious to know how you made it. I don't want you to read code out loud in a podcast. That would be...
No, we did that on Swift Python last episode. That was fun.
Yeah, that would be quite interesting here. But explain to me, how are you able to have what looks like a sort of a popover? It pops out from a menu and it shows this little balloon-looking thing completely customized and textured using the game textures. Kind of reminds me of the old iOS 6 days, in a sense, because
right.
It has this wood texture and this grass behind it. So tell me about this, because it looks like it will be quite challenging to do in Swift UI.
It was very challenging to do that in Swift UI. And it's, again, one of those things where, you know, just because I decided I wanted to try to use Swift UI here, it was something that I kept pursuing, right? But I did think to myself many times during this process, maybe I should just go back to UI Kit, you know? But then I knew I would have to implement it because I do want to ship this game on, if I ever do ship it, which I hope I will. That's my goal. On all Apple's platforms. So then I would have to also write an AppKit version, which is not a big problem. But, you know, that fact did kind of encourage me to keep pursuing the Swift UI path, even though, like you say, it was a little bit challenging here with a declarative model. So we'll put a link or a image in the chapter art. So if you look at your podcast player right now, you should be able to see this UI that we're talking about here. So like Rambo mentioned, it's like a menu and then there's this popover that comes out of the menu. And the challenge was to position this popover in the right position. And SwiftUI does have a popover API that you can use, but it's using the system appearance. And in this case, I wanted to use my own like game UI. So I wanted to build something custom. So what I ended up doing, I went through many different iterations here. So the challenge was, how do I position this menu correctly? Because in UIKit, what I would do is that I would register a button tap event, and then inside of that handler, I will just look at the frame of the button, right? Mm-hmm. Just look at where is the button, and then position the popover next to the button, right? Done.
Yeah, that's what I did for my tooltips in Chibi Studio. Basically, get the frame of the view and convert it to window coordinates so that I can position another view. And it's in a separate view hierarchy, but because you have that conversion, the ability to convert between coordinates, it's quite easy to do in UIKit.
And it's super easy in UIKit to convert a coordinate from one system to another, mm-hmm. right? You can just say UI view, like point in and give it a view, and then it just converts it for you. So that is pretty trivial in UIKit, but not in Swift UI because of the declarative nature. You have to specify everything up front. So how do you specify where a popover is supposed to appear before the user has tapped the button, right? Before you even know the coordinates of the button.
Yeah.
So the first thing I realized I needed to do was to capture the position or the frame of the button somehow. And I did that using the preferences system. And we can put a link in the show notes to an article I wrote about that technique, that you can essentially like use a geometry reader as a background view. And then you can capture the size of a given view and then pass that up through a binding, which sounds pretty complicated, but it's not that complicated. And it also might sound a little bit hacky, but I think with the declarative nature of Swift UI, it's kind of the best tool we've got so far to kind of get that geometry information.
Yeah, and the preferences system exists for a reason, right? They wouldn't make it and, oh, you should not use it because it's a hack. No, it's there. It's there for you to use. So I don't see why it would be necessarily a hack.
Right. It's the official way to communicate from a child view upwards through the view hierarchy, mm-hmm. which is, in a declarative system, usually tricky because everything happens downwards. Like you have a hierarchy of views, you specify everything up front, the parent views determine what the child views will contain and so on, right? But this is a way to basically communicate from a child view and up towards the parent view. And then what I did was that I took the popover and essentially just put it in a Z stack. So I created a depth stack with the menu and the popover. And then I just used an absolute position for the popover according to those sizes that I had captured. So I got the index of the button, I multiplied it by the height of the buttons, and then I got the right position.
Nice.
So that actually did end up working, but I started thinking to myself, you know what? This problem is actually quite similar to web development. Mm. So when you're doing CSS in web development, you can use absolute positions, right? Mm-hmm. You can say that this div or link or text should have absolute positions, and you give it a left and right coordinate. But that is something that usually doesn't end up scaling very well.
True.
Because you're just you're hard coding, not necessarily hard coding the numbers, but you're hard positioning a given element at a coordinate, which might not work across all different screen sizes or, you know, when people use things like dynamic type or accessibility settings. So I wanted to find a better way. So what I ended up doing was, instead of positioning the popover, I forced myself to kind of think the Swift UI way, which is to specify everything using these building blocks. So instead of positioning the popover, I positioned a spacer underneath it that then I changed the height of. So I used a frame modifier on the spacer to change the height of that spacer to push the popover upwards or downwards. And then the menu and the popover are just in a horizontal stack with a little bit of offset applied to the popover to make it render on top of the menu so it's not next to it. And that's how I achieved this layout. But I just thought it was like interesting because I started with a UIKit way of thinking. I then went to like a CSS way of thinking. And then I ended up with a Swift UI way of thinking, which I think is like part of the struggle of learning Swift UI. And I include myself in that, is that you have to kind of really change the way you approach layouts and data and everything to match the declarative nature. Because if you try to do it the old way, it will usually end up being pretty messy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things I mean when I say that after you go through that first learning curve, it gets a lot easier. Because I had the same experience while starting to work with SwiftUI. And I'm still not as proficient in SwiftUI as you are, I think. But it does get a lot easier once you start to learn how to think in this declarative way and also in a more reactive way when you want to plug things such as external objects that you use combine for binding and things like that. So it does get a lot easier, folks. If you're just getting started with SwiftUI and you're used to UIKit and you're struggling, that's completely normal. It's going to keep happening for a while, but then it gets better.
Absolutely. And it can feel a little bit frustrating also, especially if you have a lot of experience. Like I've been doing iOS development for many, many years, right? So it can feel a little bit frustrating. Like you feel like you're solving these like problems that you were solving when you were a beginner. But again, like yeah. It's like, come on, these last decade didn't give me anything. But it does give you something and you can use your experience, but you just have to try to just not solve the problem as you would have solved it maybe a year or two ago, right?
Yeah.
And I will also say that, you know, I bring all this up to say that this might sound like that's a big negative of SwiftUI, and it is a challenge with SwiftUI. Like the declarative nature is a trade-off. It's not just a perfect system that works for everything. And sometimes building certain layouts is more challenging, like conceptually, than it would be when you just build it like imperatively using something like UIKit. But I will say that with this particular view, which I thought in the beginning or at parts during this challenge, I thought it was almost impossible, but it ended up with very little code and it ended up being quite elegant, I think, at the end. And that is just something that, you know, I think you have to kind of go through. And again, it can be challenging depending on your deadlines and how much time you have. And maybe if you have a really tight deadline, maybe using something like SwiftUI for this is not the best tool because you need to execute fast. But if you do have the time and you do end up learning and you do try different things and end up with a good result that matches SwiftUI's design, then you can actually end up with something that is relatively simple. If I compare the amount of code that this now took at the end to what it would look like in UIKit, I think the UIKit version would be way more complicated at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true. And you also get all of the advantages of SwiftUI, which we already talked about, such as the reactive nature of it. And I think this is not a case with Swift UI, like you mentioned. It's a case of you being an experienced developer in some technology and you're moving from being an experienced developer in a technology and a beginner in a completely new technology. It's basically what's happening. Like, you're a super experienced UI kit developer. When you first start with Swift UI, you're a beginner in Swift UI. You know all of the other stuff that's around it. So if you want to make an app that uses, I don't know, core location or AV foundation or something like that, that's going to be super easy for you, that part. But the UI part with Swift UI is still going to be new. So you're going to struggle a little bit in the beginning. But that's because you're a beginner.
Exactly. And I really think it's important to treat it that way, especially if you are a senior developer, to try to put on the beginner mindset or the beginner glasses, right? And try to like treat it that way. Treat it as a fun challenge and something to learn, something new. And that's really how I've been treating it. And I'm not saying that SwiftUI doesn't have any problems. It really does. It has, like any technology, it has problems. But I still find it fun and entertaining and inspiring to learn something new. Even though I won't be using it for everything, I will still use UIKit for certain things, AppKit for certain things. I will mix and match for certain things. But I think it's a really fun time to be in developer for Apple's platforms.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm loving it.
So what about you, Rambo? What have you been up to?
So nothing much has changed since last week. I'm still working on that new side project of mine, still working on AirBuddy 2.0. I've been doing some stuff which involves machine learning, which is quite fun because just as with Swift UI, machine learning is a very big topic and also very new to me. So I don't have a lot of experience. I've never actually deployed anything that uses machine learning. This might be the first time, or maybe not. We'll see. But yeah, I'm having quite a bit of fun with that. But with this new side project we talked about last week, which I haven't revealed what it is yet to anyone,
yeah,
not even you.
I am really intrigued. I don't even know, which I usually know, right? You usually give me a little bit of a hint, but this, you've been really consistent. Like, I'm not going to tell you what it is. You don't even have to ask. I'm just going to say it's really cool.
Doubling down on secrecy, right?
Yeah, really.
yeah, I'm just doing this not because it's a super like new thing that's never been done before and I don't want anyone to copy it. It has nothing to do with that. It's just that I think it will be fun. Just a little surprise for everyone. If I ever ship it. If I don't, you'll never know. But I'm currently going back and forth in my head. It's like, you know, when you have a thought in your mind and you're just having this same debate with yourself in your head throughout the day, that's been happening with me lately. And it's between deciding whether to do something on the client side or doing it on the server side. And I still haven't decided. So this is in this side project, I have a task that I have to do in the app that could be done either way. It could be on the server or on the client. And both have clear advantages and disadvantages. So I'm currently still thinking about it, whether I should do it on the client or server side. But we're not going to discuss that now because our deep dive this week, cliffhanger here, is going to be about our server side strategy and what we do on for our servers. And we're going to discuss this in more depth.
Yeah, but maybe we can just discuss a little bit first here, like in general, what your approaches when you do have these discussions with yourself or with others around whether to implement something on the client side or server side, because I do think that this is a very common challenge or source of discussion for a lot of teams. I know that, you know, all the teams that I've worked on, it's always been a discussion like, what do we put in the data from the server versus what do we do on the client side? Do we like pre-compute a certain value on the server and then send it to the client? Or does this client take the data it gets from the server and compute the value itself? And we talked also about like backend driven UIs, right, on a previous episode. And that's kind of taking that to the extreme of saying like, let me do even like UI computations and maybe not metrics, but like what UI to display, localization and things like that on the server. So I feel like there's a very broad spectrum around like where you implement certain features. So what would you say is like your general way of thinking and the debate that you're having with yourself around this?
I think we should rename our show to It Depends Cast, because
yeah,
the answer is it depends. So in most cases, I am a huge fan. And I mean, really, like, I really, really love the idea of doing as much as possible on device. Not only because it's cheaper, like you don't have to run servers if you don't need to do anything on the server side. And also there's the privacy advantages because you keep user data local. And also you the device is usually the place where the most knowledge is about the environment and the user, and we're of course talking in generic terms here, but things such as, let's say your app deals with location data, you have location data on device. And if you're going to send that to a server, that's a big problem. Like, you really should not. And if you are going to, then there's a lot of regulatory stuff you have to worry about. So if you can do things such as location data and maybe geofencing and things like that on device, it's going to be better. And yeah, the same goes for machine learning, which I just talked about. There are lots of APIs out there and services that will do machine learning on the cloud or the cloud. But then it's, again, it's another situation where you're probably going to end up sending your users' data to a third party, which is even worse. So mainly in terms of my stance on privacy, I really, really believe in doing everything on device as much as possible. But again, with server side, there are lots of advantages. And one of the big ones, which is what usually tips the scale when it comes to deciding, is you can update your server side code whenever you want. And you can patch problems live without having to deploy a new update of your app. And that's a big advantage of server-side development. And there's also an advantage of scale. So if you can do something in a more efficient way because of the scale, like you have this server or servers which is serving multiple users, there are advantages of scale which you can have, such as caching, pre-computing things, like you mentioned. So again, it depends. It's very, and that's why I'm having this debate right now, and I haven't decided yet.
Right. Yeah, those are some really good points. And I will throw in another pro and another con in the mix as well. And an advantage of server-side development for me, or keeping logic server-side, is that you can also share it between platforms without having to resort to any cross-platform UI tools. And I just praised Swift UI for being that. and that is nice. And there are also a lot of other tools that you can use to ship on iOS and Android and other platforms. But on the server, you don't have to worry about any of those things because you're usually talking to the same server regardless of platform. So you can keep your logic kind of centralized.
Yeah.
But a disadvantage of that is also availability and latency. So if you're running offline, you can't talk to your server, right?
Yeah.
Or if you need something to be really responsive and quick, you can't always rely on your server being easily reached and fast, because you could have slowness due to so many different factors like internet connection speeds, load on your server. You could have temporary problems, infrastructure problems. Like, there's so many things that can affect the client and server communication. So it is a very tricky thing. You say that you tend to favor client-side logic. I would almost say that I'm the opposite, actually. Or actually, it depends, to use your word again. If I'm building something on my own, I usually tend to go for client-side logic because, well, I'm mostly a client-side developer these days, and I like using Swift. I like using, you know, client-side type of technologies and UI libraries. So I usually use more client-side logic on my own. But when I work with teams and I work on products that ship on multiple platforms, I typically lean more towards server side just because of that multi-platform unification angle that I talked about earlier. And if you already are talking to a server, if you're already downloading JSON, why not send some additional information or compute that JSON in a different way so that the client doesn't have to repeat the same logic twice? You know, that's kind of my general way of thinking.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And at the Jobby Job, we do a lot of that, like we mentioned with the backend-driven UI thing, because then you're talking about bigger teams, and also you do have people who are focused on doing backend development. So it's not like that. There is no question of, oh, I'm going to have to be doing both of the server side and the client side work. So it changes a lot when you're talking about a company or a team.
Yeah, of course.
But of course, you should still keep in mind all of the privacy implications and things like that. But there are ways to mitigate some of the issues we talked about with server side, such as the privacy issue and the latency issue. But we're going to talk about them in the deep dive.
Now you finally get your segue or your cliffhanger. All right. But now let's move into our In the News segment. And we have a really interesting couple of topics on this one. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stacktrace is brought to you by iMazing, the most popular all-purpose iPhone and iPad manager for Mac and PC. You can head over to iMazing.com/Stacktrace to learn more and to get a 30% discount on your license. With iMazing, you can make Time Machine-style scheduled backups of your iOS devices to your own storage over either Wi-Fi or USB. And then once you have a local copy, you can browse files, photos, contacts, calendars, Safari bookmarks, and more straight from any backup snapshot, and you can recover just what you need. Backups can and should be encrypted, and they're 100% compatible with iTunes and Finder backups. And for developers, iMazing's file browser is a great way to get precious insights into how iOS's file system is structured without having to jailbreak your device. It lets you understand what parts of your app's data gets backed up, what kind of data a third-party SDK store, and it lets you quickly test various scenarios by populating your app's library and documents folder with test files. In fact, Rambo, I think that you've been using iMazing yourself for some of these tasks, am I right?
That's true. I've been using iMazing to manage my iOS devices for a while now. And I actually had the pleasure of meeting the iMazing team at last year's WWDC. Remember traveling, John? That was fun, right?
Right. Back in the day in ancient history.
Yeah. So it's a really great service and app, and it's really easy to use. And the best thing is you don't have to use Finder or iTunes, which, as our listeners will know, the interface might not be the best. And iMazing really, really helps with backing up devices. And encrypted iTunes-style backups are the best types of backups when you want to restore your device later, because it restores pretty much everything. So I really, really recommend it. And the testing aspect of being able to swap out different document folders for your app for testing is awesome. And I can also use it when preparing marketing material. So I have all of this data that I've prepared for my marketing material, and I can just replace the library folder of my app with the marketing data, and it looks like an app that's being used by a real person.
Oh, that's very smart. That's very clever. I will probably steal that trick, actually. iMazing is also continuously updated to support the latest macOS versions, the latest iOS versions. It even supports the iOS 14 beta already. It's fully supported. Other development-oriented features include a device console, access to device log files, the ability to install iOS without erasing it, exit recovery mode, battery diagnostics, and so much more. So head over to iMazing.com/Stacktrace to try iMazing for free right now. And by using that link, you not only help support me and Rambo and help us continue to make Stacktrace, you will also get a 30% discount on your iMazing license as well. And that offer is valid until iOS 14 gets publicly released. But just like I mentioned, you can also try it completely for free by heading to iMazing.com/Stacktrace. Thanks a lot to iMazing for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so it's now time for our In the News segment, and we have a quite big story this week, because four of the biggest tech company CEOs appeared in front of the US Congress during the past week to talk about anti-competitive behavior, potential regulation around these kind of things. And we're not going to go too much into detail around all of the kind of political aspects because, well, this is not a politics podcast, right? But we do love to talk about Apple things, and we do love to talk about, you know, how Apple behaves and what the future might look like for some of these things. And some interesting things came up as Tim Cook was testifying during the session. And do you want to maybe just like bring up some of those kind of key points that we want to talk about here?
Yeah, sure. So the two main points, and they're both technical, were about how Apple treats third-party apps when compared to their own apps. And when we talk about Apple's apps, we're specifically talking about Apple apps which are downloaded from the App Store. So things such as Keynote Pages, Numbers, iMovie, the Clips app, those types of apps, not the apps that come pre-installed with the operating system. And by the way, just to make it clear, some of these apps, when you buy a new iPhone, they will install automatically once you configure the device, but they are not a part of the operating system. They're just installed automatically because you get them for free with a new purchase. Because some people were confused about, oh, the Clips app is built in. It's not. It's in the App Store, but when you buy a new device, it's downloaded automatically.
Do you feel like that distinction is kind of relevant? Like, because like you say, most people feel like it's a built-in app anyway. Like, because you can't even quote-unquote delete built-in apps now. It only hides them, right? So if you reinstall them again, it's a very quick download.
It actually deletes them now since iOS 12, I think. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So, but anyway, like, do you feel like that distinction is important? The fact that they come from the App Store and that they're not in the OS technically?
I think so. And also, there are other apps which are never downloaded automatically when you buy a new device, such as Final Cut Pro, Xcode. And I'm sure there are some apps in the iOS App Store as well, but I don't remember. I don't have the full list of Apple apps here. But
I wish that Logic would be automatically downloaded for free when you buy a new device. That would be great.
That would be awesome, yeah. So I do think it does make a difference, but something that's important to focus on, and I noticed when I tweeted about this, is people tend to focus too much on the examples and don't focus on the actual problem itself. So please, let's focus on the problem and not the specific examples I'm going to give here, okay? That's a plea for our listeners. So the first aspect is that Apple treats all developers the same when it comes to the deal that they get when they join the App Store. So the 30% cuts for paid content in the app, and also 30% the first year for subscriptions, 15% in the following years for the same subscription. That's not true. Tim mentioned that it is the same to all developers, but that is not the case. We know, and we have even documents that show this, that some developers get the 15% deal from the get-go. Like, they don't have to wait for the first year of a subscription. And I think the two top examples are Amazon and Netflix.
Yeah, and those are some like big high-profile examples, but you know, Apple, they have a developer evangelism team, right? Yeah. And they reach out to certain developers around like trying to encourage them to do certain things, whether it's putting apps in the App Store, whether it's implementing new features. And they reach out to some and not to others, depending on how high profile a given app is, right?
True.
And that makes sense. Like, if you are running a platform and you want to try to get developers to use certain features, of course, you should reach out to them and talk to them and offer them incentives, right?
Yeah.
But it was really kind of shocking. I mean, I know that these things, like, it's a political event. It's a different political structure than we're both used to, right? Because we don't live in the US. But it's still really shocking and weird to see Tim Cook go up there and, like, testify and say something that is clearly not true, right? I mean, it's something that we can look at it and see, like, well, this is not true. It kind of felt really weird.
Yeah, exactly. And again, another disclaimer here. Both me and John, I think we agree that we're not saying that Apple shouldn't do this, or maybe even if I were running the App Store, I would probably do the same. Like, I would offer special offers for high-profile developers. The point here is that he was asked specifically if all developers got the same deal, and he answered yes, but the correct answer is no. So that's the point we're making here.
It should be like in Jeopardy, where if you make the wrong answer, it goes like...
Yeah, so that's the first aspect. The second one is even more interesting, and that's when Tim Cook was asked about whether Apple's own apps, which are published in the App Store, have to follow the same rules as third-party apps, to which he answered yes, but no.
Another incorrect answer there. Minus 1,000 points for Tim Cook.
Yeah, so this is another tricky topic in practical terms. Again, I'm not sure I disagree that this should be the case. I think probably it should, but the answer was yes. And we know that Apple's apps don't have to follow the same rules. I mean, if they had to follow the same rules, Xcode wouldn't be allowed in the App Store.
Right, exactly.
It's not even sandbox. I think Final Cut Pro is not sandbox either. And there are some special entitlements Apple's apps get, such as the Clips app doesn't ask you for permission to use your camera when you launch it, and it gets access to your camera and microphone by default. So that's because they have a special entitlement that lets them do that, and only Apple can do. This is something only Apple can do, John. They love saying that in their keynotes. So that's also not the case. Not that I'm saying here that I think the Clips app should ask if you allow Apple to access your microphone or camera, but it's weird.
It is really weird, and it's kind of like I mentioned earlier, seeing like Tim Cook like testifying and saying something that, you know, both me and you and a lot of other people know is like, maybe there's some kind of lawyer way to kind of like figure it out to say, oh, actually it was true if you look at it like this and this and this. I don't know. We're not lawyers, right? We're not politicians. We don't know how this works, but it feels like it's not true, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of worrying. I mean, not only if someone lies when they're testifying, that is worrying, but also like, it kind of feels like Apple believes that they're doing certain things that they're not, right? Or that they're doing certain things like so correctly and without any like special treatment to anybody, and all the rules are so fair. And then what we see in reality is not really the case. And that is kind of worrying, that kind of disconnect between what is actually happening and what they're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that hasn't been done only in this situation. In press statements, Apple loves to say, even recently with the Hey app situation, they love to say that they treat all developers the same and that every developer follows the same rules and things like that. And they never came as far as saying that Apple's own apps follow the same rules as all other developers. Which I think is what's really new here. Like, it's the shocking aspect here is that you could maybe argue that all developers share the same treatment, but not that Apple's apps follow the same rules.
Exactly. And we know that big companies, when they release press statements and when they talk like this, like officially, they will always bend things and say things in a way that makes it seem favorable to them, right?
Exactly.
Like makes them seem good. And that is just, you know, that's just what it is. But again, this feels like it's almost like across the line, right? It's like, it's not only like saying something favorably, it's like saying something that feels like it's not true. And that something that a lot of developers are upset about. Like, there's been a lot of debate. You mentioned Hey, there's been a lot of debate in the community for years now, not only with Hey, but I mean, since the early days of the App Store, there's been debates back and forth around Apple's control of the App Store, you know, the different deals different people make, the rules that are there. And like, it just feels like it's frustrating to see this kind of disconnect between the reality in what they're saying. And I just wish that it was a little bit more empathetic towards developers, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, I know that they're not going to go up there and like confess, right? We did it wrong. Yeah, I'm not expecting that. But I was hoping to see maybe a little bit more like the fact that they are aware of this as a problem, but it feels like it's almost like they're not.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So yeah, we'll see what's going to happen here. I did really enjoy John Gruber and Nilay Patel talking about the whole event in general on the talk show. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Is that what they call follow-out, Rambo? Is that what the cool kids call it?
Yeah, that's correct. Follow-out.
All right. Awesome. Cool. But now let's talk about some more positive news. And that's that Apple did launch a new product, Rambo.
Oh, nice. Which is it?
Oh, you're acting surprised? You don't know?
No, I haven't been reading the news.
All right. So they launched a new iMac.
Oh, a new iMac. That's really cool. And it has that super cool new design that looks like the little Pixar lamp or something.
It does not. Oh. And no Apple Silicon either. But it's a spec bump and it does have a couple of new cool features around the display and things like that. But it's kind of a minor update, but still nice to just see like a refreshing of the iMac and the iMac Pro as well.
Yeah, that was just an upgrade to the core count of the low-end model. If there is such a thing as a low-end iMac Pro.
Right.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And something that's interesting about this, and we don't have to go into detail about the specs. I mean, people can read that on Apple's website. But something that's interesting about this, a couple of things. First of all, I'm surprised that the iMac Pro is still a thing. I was under the impression that they would remove the iMac Pro from the lineup and just offer beefier iMacs that would match it.
I think maybe the thing is here that they didn't want or couldn't do a redesign right now. And in order to fit that kind of thermal envelope and all of those things into the regular iMac, they might have needed to do some changes, like, for example, adopt the cooling system from the iMac Pro. And they might have not been able to achieve that right now. And it might also be a thing where maybe there's an Apple Silicon iMac in the works, and maybe they didn't want to spend too much effort and energy on this update when they know that there's a new one coming later, which we don't know, but you know, that might be an explanation.
Yeah, I think there's clearly a redesigned iMac in the works because there have been some reports and leaks about this. So I think it's probably coming next year, and it's probably going. I think the mistake in the reports was that this redesigned iMac would be an Intel iMac, which, looking back in hindsight, it makes no sense. Like, why would they release a redesigned iMac with Intel? If they're redesigning the iMac, which is a huge task, why? Like, why do it with Intel? Redesign it for Apple Silicon, of course, and release it next year. The Apple Silicon transition is supposed to last like 2 years, but I think we're going to see that happening more quickly if everything goes according to plan. And I think this redesign iMac is probably going to be Apple Silicon. Which brings us to the question, is this something we should be getting right now if we're in the market for a desktop Mac?
It depends, right? It's always hard to make these kind of purchasing recommendations on a podcast because everyone has a different situation. I am kind of semi in the market for a new computer because, you know, my non-pro laptop has served me well now for a few years. But I do feel like I could use an upgrade, especially with all the Swift UI work I've been doing lately. I can say that it sounds like my 13-inch MacBook Pro is going to take off to the moon when I am using the Swift UI previews on multiple devices at once. Like, I'm really putting that poor CPU under a lot of load. So I have been thinking about getting a new computer. But at the same time, you know, that Apple Silicon is just around the corner. I'm just not sure. This does look a nice machine. And when I first looked at it, I was like, maybe I should get this one because it would be a huge performance boost for me. But I am also really intrigued just to see what they're going to do with Apple Silicon. So I don't know, like if you need a new computer right now and you can't wait, maybe get this one. Also, there might also be challenges with Apple Silicon, right? It might not be this huge success right out of the gate. I kind of sort of like being an early adopter in some context, so maybe I will accept that, but we will see when that day comes. But yeah, it is a tricky situation if you're going to buy a Mac now, I think.
Yeah, You know, that's something that could be a whole topic, but I really don't get it when people talk about, oh, you shouldn't buy the first generation of... I don't agree that that's a thing these days.
Well, butterfly keyboard?
No, I mean, the butterfly keyboard was a huge issue, but it wasn't a first generation issue. It was an issue, period.
Right, that's true.
It was something that should never have been released, but speaking about, like, I've gotten the first generation of pretty much everything Apple does in the past 5 years, I think. And the only problem I've had was with the butterfly keyboard. And it wasn't a first generation thing. In fact, I did get the first generation MacBook Pro with the butterfly keyboard. That one didn't have any problems. It was the second generation one I had a problem with. So I don't know. I don't think they would risk... having, and of course there are some issues you can't predict, but I don't think they would risk Apple Silicon, the first Apple Silicon Max, having any significant big issues. I think that would be too big a risk to make. I think they are really doubling down on QA for that hardware. I don't even know if it's called QA in hardware, but yeah, I don't think they will risk having any big issues. I am going to buy the first generation Apple Silicon Mac, and I'm going to be happy with it, I hope.
You've already decided. You've already given a 10 out of 10 in your review.
Exactly. I'm already reviewing it.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, so I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Going back to the iMac thing, I did tell you it could be a whole topic, the first generation thing. Yeah. So I'm with you. I think if you are looking to get a Mac and you really need a desktop Mac right now, the first iMac-looking Apple Silicon Mac is probably going to come out next year, probably the second half, maybe even not that. So it's quite a while for you to get that. So get one right now. But the thing that made me not want a desktop was the fact that I was going to the office pretty much every day or at least half the week. That has changed. I don't know if you've noticed, but people aren't going out.
I have noticed.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm in the market for a desktop Mac. But again, I think it's possible that the office will be reopening-ish. Till the end of the year. But then we're going to have the same situation again next year. I'm sorry, but it's probably going to be the case. So I think maybe it's not the time for me to get this iMac. I'm probably going to wait for the Apple Silicon one. But I do plan on moving to desktop for my main machine in the future.
Yeah, same here. I've been mentioning it on the show before, but my kind of long-term plan is to have a really powerful desktop and then just use my iPad when I'm on the go, which, like you mentioned, I haven't been much on the go lately. I've been mostly at home. But, you know, it's always good to future-proof your setup as well. I mean, hopefully this pandemic that we're in will not last forever and that we can eventually like start traveling and do things quote-unquote normally as we did before. So I don't want to only optimize my setup for only staying at home. But I think the iPad, iMac combination or whatever it ends up being could work really well.
The cool kids are calling it the new normal, John.
Right, the new normal. That's right. All right, Rambo. But now let's go into our deep dive segment. And like you mentioned earlier, now we're finally going to climb off of the cliff, right? We're going to climb up. We've been hanging on this cliff forever, but now we're finally up. We're going to talk about the difference between client and server-side development. And you mentioned earlier when we talked about it in the beginning of the show, how scalability is kind of a different thing when you talk about it from a client-side perspective and a server-side perspective. So could we perhaps just dive a little bit deeper into that? Like, what do we mean when we talk about scalability, especially like, what does scalability mean on the client side?
Well, you have the issue that you don't have with server side, which is you don't have to worry about that particular code affecting your user's device. Things such as battery life and CPU usage and memory usage. So you don't have that worry. Of course, if you are hitting your server every millisecond from the user's device, it is going to affect battery life. But I mean, in terms of actual processing. But you do have to worry about scalability in a different way, because you're going to potentially have millions of clients hitting the same server at the same time. And that can be a problem.
Yeah, exactly. And then we start talking about things like availability and, you know, what do you do if something actually ends up getting more traffic than you expected and you get this spike? How do you do like load balancing? And if something does go wrong, how do you make sure that you get notified, right? And then we get into the whole topic of like DevOps, right? Like exactly. How do you get notified that something is going wrong and how do you address it? So server-side development, I think the development itself, like when you're writing server-side code, and I've been writing a lot of server-side code throughout my career and I still do, I would, maybe this is going to offend some people, I don't know, but I kind of feel like server-side code is in general simpler than client-side code. Like, I feel like it's more straightforward, at least. Like, when I'm doing server-side development, I feel like, you know, I'm doing more like classic computer science-style logic and programming, right? I'm writing algorithms more than I'm writing these, like, stateful machines that can be in many different states and configurations. And like we talked about earlier, accessibility settings and font sizes, like, there's none of that on the server side. So I feel like writing the code, at least for me, from my perspective, is simpler on the server side, but the deployment and managing and running that code is way more complicated.
I would definitely agree with that. Yeah. And again, not to say that backend development is easy or it's simple and anyone could do it. No, it's
just write a backend, Rambo. Just write it.
Yeah, it can become very tricky. But in general, like the things we would do, like for an API for a mobile app, it's basically just again moving data from one place to another and transforming data and putting it on a database and checking if something exists and returning the right HTTP response. Like that's the gist of it. And again, if you're writing like an API for a mobile app, there are way more complicated backends you can get into, but that's not what we're talking about here. There's another huge advantage of writing backend server-side things, which is you usually know to a great extent, a great level of detail, the environment where your code is gonna run in. So with mobile app development, if you're writing an app, it can be running on lots of different devices with lots of different OS versions. You will run on devices you don't even know exist yet. So
yeah, right.
That's where the issues start to crop up. And also, UI development is extremely hard. Like, it is really, really hard doing UI development. I think I will say here, and I'm probably going to be corrected, but I think UI development is the hardest type of development to get right.
Yeah, I mean, it depends again, right? This is like the fifth time we're saying it on this episode. But yeah, there are complex UIs and there are simpler UIs. But I do agree that UI development is this kind of Pandora's box that it looks simple and then you open it and like everything breaks loose, right?
Yeah.
Because even just a single simple thing, like if you take like, let's just put a button on the screen. Again, when you consider all different things like the environments and the accessibility settings and dark mode, light mode, right to left languages, like there are so many different aspects that can influence the environment, like you say. And there are certain environmental aspects as well on the server side, like you have to manage your memory and CPU and scalability, like we just mentioned. And now also there is this trend of going kind of quote unquote serverless, right? Where you are giving a service your code to execute. For example, I know that both me and you, we like to use Cloudflare, hashtag not a sponsor, not yet. but there are other services as well, like Google, Amazon, etc. They all have these like serverless systems. And then you do actually not control the environment that well, but I would also argue that then it maybe doesn't matter as much, because it's not like in your Lambda function or in your Cloudflare worker that you are putting like an availability check if you're running on Linux or some other platform. Like, that doesn't matter to your logic in that case.
Yeah, and when I mentioned before in our initial segment about some ways to mitigate issues which can crop up with server-side development, one of the things you can do is go serverless. And I know some people like to complain about the term serverless. I mean, can't you just have fun? Like, we know it is running on a server somewhere. Of course, there is a server. But serverless means you don't have to maintain servers. So it's going to spin up an instance of your thing, run it for however long it takes, and then shut it down, and that's it. So I think the best way to eliminate many of the problems we've talked about is using a serverless approach, if you can do it. And if you can't do serverless, I would call it stateless backend development. So if you can structure your backend as something that just takes a request and gives a response without side effects and without like storing anything, that's the best type of backend, because it's basically a functional backend. And that's something that's often done with serverless development, because by its nature of being serverless, you end up structuring things in a less stateful way.
Yeah, that's true. And you also do more separation of concerns, right?
Yeah.
Because one thing I really like about Cloud Functions is that both the functional aspect that you get some input and you produce output, you can do it asynchronously. You can, depending on the environment, sometimes you have APIs for doing multi-threading and things like that. But at the end of the day, you're like responding to a request and sending a response back. And that can be then spun up and executed on many different servers or threads. Like, that doesn't matter so much to you. You're just writing your code. But on the separation of concerns aspect is like, when I have to write things as separate functions, separate files with separate deployments, I'm kind of naturally separating those concerns. I don't have this big blob of logic that is all kind of talking to each other and have, you know, potential for deadlocks, or maybe not deadlocks, but causing latency problems if something gets turns into a bottleneck and things like that. And I try to do that also when I'm running my own servers as well. Like, I've been working on a new implementation of search for Swift by Sundell. And this is something I haven't talked about publicly. So big reveal here on Stacktrace. But yeah, I'm continuing to iterate on my website. Big surprise, right?
And you think we're going to love it?
I think you're going to love it. Yeah, and I can't wait to see what you do with it. I can't wait to see how many things you're going to search for. So I've been working on a new like search algorithm, and I've been wanting to implement that in a different way. And I'm probably going to deploy that as a separate server, like a separate server altogether, because search is one of those things that can have load spikes, and it can have, you know, very hard to predict kind of performance characteristics. And I wouldn't want, like, if my website is going to go down, I don't want it to be because a lot of people were searching, right? So by putting that on a separate server, I can separate the concerns of serving the website itself versus serving search.
Yeah, let's say like Taylor Swift releases a new album, and for some reason everyone searches for her new album on your website. That would be a big problem.
Right, exactly. That would be a big problem, right? Maybe I should actually pursue that as a business deal with Taylor Swift. Let's see if that's going to work out. Anyway, so in the worst case scenario, then if that happens and I get that traffic spike and I can't handle it for some reason, then only the search feature would go down, which is not good, but it's better than my whole website going down. Mm-hmm. So I do also think that thinking about these things in terms of separation is good when it comes to server-side development.
Yeah, definitely. And another aspect that you can mitigate by using not just serverless, but specifically edge computing. And a good example of edge computing is Cloudflare Workers. Hashtag not a sponsor again. But we use it a lot, so that's why we talk so much about it. But with your code running on the edge, so instead of running on a centralized location, a data center, say in the US, which is very common, you can have your code spread out across all of the network, and Cloudflare has servers in like pretty much every country almost. You eliminate a lot of that problem, especially with regulations that say that you have to store data in the person's country. So if I am visiting or using my app from Brazil, it's going to be using Cloudflare servers in Brazil, and my code is going to be running there. And even if I store data using the key value store thing, it's going to be stored locally here. So that's a big advantage of edge computing, that you can eliminate a lot of that regulatory issue about having to store user data in a particular global location.
We should also point out that Stacktrace is not official legal advice.
Exactly. Yeah. But they do have great documentation. So you can, there's a post on their blog recently. We can link to that where they talk about more detail about the regulatory implications.
Yeah, but also like from a performance aspect as well. Like if you can run your code on a DNS level, that's closer to the user.
Yeah.
And that's like the quote unquote secret sauce, not so secret actually, to why sites like mine and yours and others are so fast, is that we are relying a lot more on CDN, like content delivery network logic, and DNS logic, like things running on those kinds of servers to run our websites, which is way faster than having to do a whole round trip to a central server, like you mentioned. And also like the deployment aspect, like being able to just like go in and deploy and just goes out immediately to the entire network is easier than having to manage your own deployment and your own servers. I kind of do both. Like I know that you are kind of moving almost all of your things to Cloudflare, if I'm not mistaken, like most of them at least.
Yeah.
I still do kind of like a hybrid approach. I still do some things on my own servers and some things on Cloudflare and on the CDN. It depends mostly for me on the level of control. And also like, I don't want to be too locked into one provider. So that's also why I don't use these kind of very high level web services that just say, give me your markdown and I will deploy it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't like those so much because I feel like I don't want to put my entire website into the hands of one service. So I like to spread the risk a little bit, Rambo, so that if one thing, you know, becomes a problem, I can kind of move to another thing.
Yeah, and another problem with these hugely managed things, like you mentioned, you just give us your markdown, is that they're usually way more expensive than just running your own server. And I think most developers who are not experienced with running servers, they think it's like this huge deal that's going to be super complicated and take out like a huge chunk of your time. It's really not. Like it's quite easy if you're not doing something with a huge scale. But for things such as like my apps, like I do run quite a few servers and I use also Cloudflare quite a bit. It doesn't take any amount of my time at a regular basis. It only takes time when I actually want to change something or fix something. But in general, like it's quite easy to do that. And you are right, like Rambo.codes, it's completely on the CDN. It doesn't have a server, basically. So my website is serverless, all the buzzwords.
That's awesome. It is really cool, actually, that you can serve an entire website directly from the CDN. I remember the good old days when, or actually not so good in this context, I would say the new days are better in this case, where you would only store like images and videos maybe on a CDN, and then the website would still be served always from the server. Using a CDN like this is so much easier in terms of scale. I actually, just before we started recording, I got an email from Cloudflare, our good friends at Cloudflare, and they sent me a snapshot of my July, and it said that I saved 1.2 terabytes of data by using Cloudflare in July, which is kind of crazy because, you know, my website is serving like HTML, CSS, and images. That's it. And 1.2 terabytes of data, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, but it's serving that to a lot of people.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got the same email, John. Well, not actually the same email, but you know what I mean.
Right.
And you win this month because I only saved like 600 and some gigabytes of bandwidth.
Yeah, but that's still a very large number as well. Yeah. So it's kind of funny just how quickly the numbers tick up when you talk about like web and servers and that kind of web scale, as they call it, right? So yeah, it is a different world than client-side development, that's for sure.
Yeah, and by the way, I still don't know the answer to the original question. Should I do it on the client or on the server? I'll keep you updated.
Sounds good. But now let's round off this episode with our Ask Stacktrace segment. And I just want to say that I've been really enjoying seeing all the great questions that you've been submitting lately. So please keep that up. Like, getting questions from you, the listeners, is so much fun. And I know that we just have time usually to answer one or two of them, but we really do appreciate all your questions and we try to get to them as quickly as we can. So please continue to ask us questions because we do really love to get that feedback and to be able to also have you listeners like influence the content of the show as well.
Yeah.
So the question we're going to answer this week comes from Andy. And Andy says, if you guys are developing an app for a third party as a freelancer, do you expect the client to be familiar with the App Store rules? And how do you protect yourself against rejection reasons that are out of your control if you do believe that you followed all the rules? So this is a very interesting question, I feel like. Like, I've definitely had challenges with this in the past, but I'm going to start first like throwing this over to you, Rambo, and just because you haven't done that much freelancing lately, you are working at the Jobby Job. So how do you usually kind of relate to this particular challenge with App Store rejections?
Actually, fun fact, I have never done a freelance job on iOS.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay.
Never. So I may do that in the future, but I've never done it. And not because I think it's bad or something. It's just never occurred that I would do it. But I do have experience at the Jobby Job because sometimes you have to deal with App Store rules in a work context where you do have people which are equivalent to a client. Like you have a product manager or someone higher up at the company, and they don't necessarily know about the App Store rules. And I don't think they should know. Like, it's normal for not everyone at the company will know everything about everything, right? So you have specialists for that reason.
Right.
So I think it's important, first of all, to explain to the client, or in this case, your boss, what the rules are. And to always keep an eye out for things that might have problems with App Store rules. So whenever I see like a ticket for a new feature or a change that's going to be done in the app, the first thing I always do is check if that might have any implications with the App Store. And we've had instances in the past. Unfortunately, I don't remember any specific cases I could tell you about, but we definitely had things in the past where there was this idea to implement something or do something in a different way, and I immediately spotted like, oh, this is going to be a problem, and I had to go and explain to the product manager and show them the App Store rules and explain the issue. And in this case where it's at a work environment and everyone is on the team, it's usually easier because if you can show them that it's a problem, then they will usually understand and then you'll change the feature or the change accordingly. When it's a client, I would like to know your opinion, John, since you're more used to dealing with freelancing clients on the iOS side of things. But yeah, I really don't have any suggestions there just because I've never done freelancing on iOS. So what are your tips, John?
My first rule of freelancing is to only have one expectation from your client, and that's for them to pay you. Don't have any other expectations, basically. Because like you mentioned, you can't assume that any person will be familiar with the App Store rules. And I think if you are a freelancer, you're kind of responsible also not only for the programming side, like actually writing the code, but also some of the business aspects as well. Yeah. Like if you take on a project from a client, especially if you do it on your own, I think you need to also like do some research around like, is this even possible technically? Is this feasible? Is this something I will be able to do in the a lot of time? Is it going to be allowed by Apple? Right? There's all this kind of research and investigation that you have to do around the project before you even start writing the code.
Yeah, this is something that I did when I worked with web development, and I was a freelancer doing web development. And it's very common for a client to approach you with a solution.
Like, exactly.
I want this. And then it's your job as a freelancer to reverse that and get to which problem they have that they want to solve. Because if they come to you and, oh, we want an app that does this, you need to go back and rewind a little bit and understand what their problem is. so that you as a professional can propose the best solution.
Exactly. And it also really helps to do that to kind of understand their context and to understand like their objectives, like you say, because I don't think I've worked on a single product that has shipped the exact way that was originally specified, yeah. right? Because people change their minds during the development time, you gain new information, sometimes you need to take some shortcuts or cut scope in order to meet some deadline. There are all sorts of things that can happen. So I think familiarizing yourself with the core objectives of the product is really important. And the App Store rules really tie into this, I feel like, where you know, try to get an understanding of, is this going to be allowed or not? And then to explain it to the client, if you identify something that you think could be problematic, to, you know, bring that up with them and to see like, you know, how could we work around this? And to also do some kind of risk management there with them, right? So that yeah. you don't feel like you are the one taking the risk, right? Because exactly. if the app gets rejected, it's on you, that you've shared that information with them so that they are in it with you, right? They are aware of the risks and they can then choose to go for it anyway or to, you know, modify things.
You know, that now that I think about it, you made me think, John, if I were to do any iOS freelancing, that would be a part of my contract. Like that I am not responsible for App Store rejections or something.
Yeah, and that gets to the second part of this question here. How do you protect yourself against rejections? So again, we're not lawyers. This is not legal advice. But I do also recommend to at least not structure your deal in a way that it says that you only get paid if the app appears on the App Store. Because there are so many things that could happen. Not only app rejections, but you know, try to make sure that you get paid for the work that you've done, of course. But when it comes to this, like back in the day when I started as a freelancer on Apple's platforms, it was way more common with app rejections. And I think that this is something that a lot of people either don't know or don't remember, that back in the day, like in, let's say 2010, 10 years ago, it was very common to get rejected a lot and to yeah. wait a lot of time. So what I would do when I was a freelancer is that I would take the deadline that the client had. Like I was working for some companies that wanted to do like apps with together with ad campaigns, and they had some date where they wanted the app to be in the App Store. I then took that date and like reversed it by 1.5 months just to give us enough time for rejections. Like that was the deal back then. And, you know, I'm not saying that was good. That was just how it was. And I think that that's something you also should consider when you're like communicating with the client, when you're setting up deadlines and things like that, to not say like, okay, we need the app to be live on the, let's say, 10th of October. Okay, let's submit it to the App Store on the 5th of October. Like that's that's probably not a good strategy.
Yeah, definitely. And also something I see quite a bit with fellow iOS developers who do freelancing, often the client wants them to be the one hosting the app. And I am quite sure, again, not a lawyer, but I'm quite sure that Apple prohibits that. So if you are a developer, you probably do have your developer account. It's probably set up to distribute apps in the App Store. You probably have apps in the App Store. But if you're doing an app for someone else, especially if it's a business, they have to have their own Apple developer account. And you're going to be publishing the app to their account, not yours. So keep that in mind as well.
And they can invite you to their team, right? So you can act as an agent in App Store Connect on behalf of them. And that's something I've done with a lot of clients. But yes, absolutely. I would always make the client set up their own Apple account. And also, again, I want them to be familiar with this process. I don't want it to be like they are only interacting with me and Apple is like, you know, I'm in control of Apple because I'm not. You know, I want them to deal with Apple directly. I don't want, you know, everything to just go through me. I will write the code and I will help them and I will help them navigate App Store Connect. I will fill in all the metadata and everything. But I want them to be in control of that process so that if something happens, it's not, they're not angry at me, right? They actually can address it with Apple, which is, you know, where the problem is in that case.
Yeah, and it's your job as well to teach them. Like probably your clients, it's often the case where they have never made an app, so they have no idea how it works. So it's your job to take some time to maybe like do a little keynote presentation and to teach them how it works. And don't just send them like a link to an article or something because they're not going to read it. It has to be like a meeting where you explain to them how it works. Kind of like, you know, when you go to like the doctor or the dentist and you're going to do a procedure, they explain to you everything that's going to happen and how it's going to work and how much time it's going to take. You should do the same thing. Like, you should explain what the App Store is, how it works, what the whole development process is like, just so that they have clear expectations of what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Because like I mentioned earlier, you really have to think of yourself not just as a programmer in this context, but as a business person, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who is like representing this part of the business, and you have to take a holistic kind of approach to it. So not just like write the code and then deliver the code, but to also talk more about the meta aspect of submitting an app, because there's a lot of complexity there.
Yeah. And if you want to be someone who only codes, then don't be a freelancer.
Or partner with someone who wants to do that stuff, right? Yeah. That's another thing you can do. You can be not just yourself. Like, you can work with a little mini team where maybe one person is more business oriented and takes care of the clients, and maybe one person is more design oriented and one person is more code oriented. Like, that's another setup you could try to achieve.
Definitely.
Cool. Thanks so much for that question, Andy, and hope you enjoyed our answer. And to all other people who have asked us questions with hashtag AskStackTrace, we'll try to answer your question as soon as we can, and please keep them coming. But that's the end of this episode, so all that remains is for us to thank our great sponsor for this episode, iMazing. Please check them out at iMazing.com/StackTrace. But most of all, thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.